Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is a dear friend. We don't know each other long, Debbie, but I think we like each other quite a bit.
We do. We had instant chemistry.
We have with us today Debbie Wasko, OBE. She is in the great city of London, which right alongside New York. I would say 50-50, equal basis, is my favorite place in the world. Debbie's extraordinarily accomplished. We met through her partner, the wonderful Anna Jones, when they conceived and developed the Albright together, which we'll talk about. But you are so much more than just that, Debbie. So it's a thrill to talk to you today. So thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So Debbie, I want to go back a ways, and all of us have different beginnings to our career. And some of us are lucky enough to be in a place that helps us build a foundation that we will go back to for years to come. You worked at a great company, a dear friend of mine is doing a lot of work with them right now, Oliver Wyman. And I'd love to go back to those early days working for Oliver Wyman and talk about that tenure. I think you were there 2-3 years, but talk about that and how that helped build a foundation that you would build on in an incredible fashion.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, when you think about the sweep of history of your life and your career. And for me, the moment of really starting to think about that was writing a book, because Anna and I co-authored a book called Believe, Build, Become, How to Supercharge Your Career. I make about 6 pence from every copy sold, by the way, so that's not really a sort of financial plug, but it was published in 2019. And I think when you do something like that, and when you do therapy, actually, it makes you think about who you are and why you are the person that you are. So for me, to take one step back before Oliver Wyman, I'm from a family that you might recognize a little bit, Matt, and that was a third generation Jewish immigrant family to the UK. And I grew up in an environment where a couple of things mattered. The first was that everybody in my family or my extended family was an entrepreneur. They would never have used that word, because that's kind of a fancy word, but they were business owners, and often the businesses were very humble, right? So I grew up in a classic immigrant culture where people sold fruit and veg on the markets, and they ran small shops, and they ran sort of schmatter businesses. And in particular, the women in my family ran the show. And I always talk about being the proud continuation of a long line of difficult women. And that was absolutely the case in terms of my grandmother, who died at 97 and inherited her husband's business when he died, which was sweet shops and off licenses. And I grew up driving around in her armored van that she never learned how to reverse. And we have that in common, because I'm a notoriously awful driver, dropping money at the bank. So I think the picture there was commerce, money, women, and also in those cultures, academic excellence is sort of non-negotiable, because that's what's simply expected. So all of that I kind of took with me. And when I was lucky enough to study in a classically academic way at Oxford, when I left Oxford and entered the world of work at Oliver Wyman, I was one of two women in my intake, in a big intake of undergraduates. And I was the only person without an engineering or maths degree. So actually for me, Oliver Wyman, I'd done philosophy and theology, was a really good lesson in what it's like to be bad at something, which had never happened to me in my life before, because I'd always sort of skipped through the world of academia. And I was definitely, Oliver Wyman now, you know, generously claimed me as one of their own, but I was like the bottom of the barrel in that series of undergraduates. And it taught me a few things. One was the power of storytelling and how to sell, because I was really good at that, even though I was less good at the analytics. And I think the firm really nurtured that. The second was the basics that have sat with me in my business life, which we don't tend to teach students at university, or definitely didn't when I was there in the 90s, and not least studying sort of Descartes' Cartesian circle, which was about cash flow and basic balance sheet maths and the importance of businesses that made money. That sounds kind of obvious, but I think that's something that I've taken with me throughout all of my businesses. I'm cash flow obsessed. I always check the bank account every day. That's kind of never left me. And a lot of that I give to Oliver Wyman, but also the power of networks. Actually, that Oliver Wyman community is still really important to me, even though I left there in 1997. And I think when you get culture right, and when I worked at the firm, I think it was 40 people, and now it's, you know, enormous. then the kernel of that culture comes with you. So they were brilliant at picking people. I think I was a less able consultant in the early years of consultancy. It's interesting because it kind of goes full circle in my life now, because I'm a senior advisor to McKinsey. So I've come back to consultancy. But, you know, when I talk to my kids and other people's, picking a first job that's a training ground, that's hard, and enables you to prioritize the simple tenet that you should do more of what you're good at. So for that reason, like moving on from there, but taking it with me was a really important first place to be based.
Well, I love that. And we learn as much in life from our failures and exposing what we're not good at. You know, it never does me any good when someone says, you know, tells me all the things that were terrific. I want to know what didn't go well. What could we do better? What did we do poorly? So I love that answer. Let's dig a little deeper on something else you referred to, which is that third generation immigrant mentality. To me, irrespective of religion, there is something to be said for that, let's call it that immigrant mentality, the work ethic, the fear-drivenness of what we do, that fear of failure, that you know, I remember my father-in-law, God bless, he's gone for quite some time now, but, you know, folks that grew up in the Depression, that never left them, even when they made a lot of money. You know, my father-in-law did very, very well, and he drove an Oldsmobile, which is a very, very plain vanilla car, right up until the end. Talk about that immigrant mentality and how that shaped you.
I mean, look, in so many ways that you're not conscious of at the time, I think I too have a fear that I'm about to be sent to a debtor's prison. You know, that kind of sits somewhere in the core, right? No matter how much. So I like money under the bed. It's a driver, not because I want a plane and a boat. I think that's been very bred into me that stuff's really important. I think there's a joyfulness in those communities. You know, my grandparents were old enough to be Holocaust survivors. My stepfather's parents had escaped from Austria, one on the Kinder transport and the other one with this unbelievable story of skiing across the Alps. When stories like that are being told, I think what I saw in those people was an amazing joie de vivre, an amazing amount of laughter, actually, a lot of food, you know, and kind of like getting together. And I think a real sense that life was to be lived and anything was possible. I think the gentrification of immigrants of whatever creed and color is also something that's really fascinating to watch. And I see it when I look at my own children who are now thoroughly English and I sort of sat somewhere on the cusp. But I think everybody got up early and worked, and I get up early and work. And I think that sense of work being a gift and of this, one of my tenets that's always been very important, which came from my grandmother, who was a mega sort of role model, outlived three husbands, was always perfectly turned out and said slightly ridiculous things to me when I was very young about always having some money in a secret bank account that your husband didn't know about. That was tenant one. And sort of to a 9-year-old, you obviously like nice things. You better make sure that you earn money. So there was sort of collection there. But I think from her, it was very much stand for something. That's another thing that's important to me. And a different version of that is if you can, you should. So that's not really to do with politics with a big P, although politics is a part of my life. But I think it's a sense of responsibility that if you can do something, you should do it. If you can stand for something in the world, if you can make a difference, then you should do that. And I think that I'd never really understood as tying right back to the early years. But when I look across me and my siblings, I would say that tenet of standing up and being counted is also very important.
Fantastic stuff, Debbie. You sit on a lot of boards, advise a lot of companies, have started a lot of companies. That has to go back, in my mind, to early days and to your formative years. Did you always have that drive and that entrepreneurial spirit?
Yes. It's so funny. My mother's finally moved out of her big house and she found a load of my school reports, which my children have found hilarious. So that, you know, you look at these things and you remember the person that you were. So I've always wanted to be the best I can be. And I have been, you know, genetically given a brain that's a gift. And I always felt like that was important. I was at a girls' school And I was always taught, actually with Samantha Glynn, there you go, another person that you know, Matt, who was at the same school as me. You know, we were always taught that you anything was possible, you could be whoever you wanted to be and whatever you wanted to be. And some really extraordinary women have come out of that school doing extraordinary things. I won this thing called Young Enterprise when I was, I think, 13 or 14, selling hair scrunchies. It was the 80s. They've actually had a resurgence, so I feel like that doesn't date me as much. And I think that I always liked that. But the things I liked about it were people and team pulling towards a goal. That's always been something that gives me real joy and energy, and relationships. You know, I'm a people person. I do all my best work in a team. I come up with all my best ideas in a business partnership. I'm very like that. I can't just sort of sit and do it myself. And I think you learn quite in your formative years what gives you energy. And what gives me energy delivers me economic upside. If I don't feel like I'm getting that, I don't do my best work. And I think that was clear to me at a reasonably young age. And then you start self-selecting that. So for me, back to this point around more joy, and I was 50 this year, and that's definitely my mantra, more joy. Joy comes from people, right? Joy comes from the people that you laugh with and the people that you win with and the people that you lose with and pick yourself up and dust yourself off with. And I think that that's what has driven my business success. I've got a really good nose for someone I'm going to have fun and make money with, right? You know, it's not always possible. And I have quite a simple kind of triangular matrix in life, which is have fun, make money, don't work with assholes, right? And we've all, whenever we compromise on number three, and all of us have done it, it doesn't work, right? So when I'm at my best, it's because I'm having fun and making money because of the people that I pick up on the journey. And I think if I've, you know, when you try and figure out what you're good at, and I'm really, really, really good at a few things, one of which is reading quickly, which sounds ridiculous, but that honestly is one of my core skills. I can get through documents very fast and retain it. And that's part of my education. But the other is I've got a really good nose for someone I'm going to have a great time with and someone where they're going to bring out the best in me and I'm going to bring out the best in them. And I'm very loyal to the people that I pick up on the journey. So because it's been my year of being 50, and my sister said to me the other day, are we done yet? Like, as only sisters can. So I'm sort of doing a full year of celebrations. I'd celebrate the people that I've picked up on the journey and I haven't let them go. And I think that's what drives our success in business, right? It's all of, we know that grit outperforms genius every day of the week. It's what I say to my kids, right? And grittiness in relationships and sticking with people, I think, is what gets you there.
What strikes me about you, Debbie, is you live and truly manifest that intersection of purpose and profit, and not just the financial definition of profit, but profit in every sense of the word. And I think there's so much to be proud of there. And the number of organizations and people that you touch is tremendous. And I'd love to talk about just some of them. I think we'll have to do three parts to talk about all the things and all the companies and not-for-profits that you advise, but a few jumped out. And one of them in particular is the Women's Prize for Fiction, which I absolutely love. And I'd love to talk about that a little bit.
So I'm a books nerd. I'm a fiction nerd. And my life's been lived through books. Books were my great joy as a child. And they're still the thing that I return to in difficult times is fiction. I suppose for me, as I get older and I try to think about the standing for something, where can I make a difference? Clearly, my personal brand is tied to women and money. That's what I'm known for talking about. And I'm, which we might chat about chairing a government review now, very, very focused on that. But the organizing thought for me around the Women's Prize was, number one, it's just the best list. Like every year, it's the list that I've read. It's been called different things in the UK, the Orange Prize, the Bailey's Prize, but it's basically the short list every year of the best English language women's fiction in the world. And the second is that female writers undersell male writers 10x, right? So like that just, that's the kind of thing that always gets me to connect with something when I think, well, hang on a minute, why is that? Like, why is it that anything that drives female economic independence gets me out of bed in the morning? And some of my most joyful moments in life have come from women's fiction, but it doesn't make women money. I think there's a bigger issue for me around creative industries. that as some of the things that happen in the UK as a result of money and cost of living crisis and politics occur, which means that the arts becomes ever underfunded, we end up with there being no diversity in terms of creative output. And I think that's a real problem. I think if women can't write because they don't earn money, that's a problem. So my connection with that prize is really meaningful. I've been on the board for 6 years. I chair the development committee. That means that I'm responsible for making sure that the prize is funded. And the prize makes an enormous difference. So one of my favorite books of the last sort of 20 years really is Fugitive Pieces. I don't know if you ever read that. And when it was nominated for the prize, longlist and then shortlist, it has sold about 1,000 copies. And then it went on to sell 25 million, right? So there's a huge amplification point around showcasing amazing female talent. So it's honestly a privilege. I also love theatre. I love fiction. I don't get to hang out with those people in my, you know, real life. But I'm a total fangirl of anyone that can produce that level of creative output. And I think it's really, really important to showcase amazing female talent and to make sure that they can carry on doing what they do best, which is to bring joy to people's life by creating amazing work.
So you raise an important issue, and that's around, let's call it, gender inequity. Here in the States, we just finished a big, big sporting event involving men and women, the NCAA college basketball tournament. And the women's final outdrew the men's final on TV. It was about 14 some odd million people watched the women's final. The men's final made 99% more in terms of the value of the broadcast rights, 99% higher than the women had a higher television rating. Talk about where we are as a society in 2024 on this notion of inequity, which filters across many, many sectors, pragmatically, all sectors of our economy and culture. And how do we start to turn the tide on that? I mean, that's a staggering statistic, 99% difference in value.
So reasons to be cheerful and reasons to be concerned. So I would like to think it's coming in women's sport. I've had the privilege of doing some work and trying to figure out what some of the solutions might be around women's football or soccer. And there are reasons to be cheerful in terms of some of the stats that you mentioned. In the end, commerce is commerce. And one would hope that we're starting to see a tipping point via things like Angel City and other things that are emanating from the US that are kind of coming over to the UK, where we're seeing rights, sponsorship, revenue, player fees increasing. But it's very, very, very slow. And there's a lot that needs to happen to set women's sport free and to decouple it from some of the way in which it's been run as a sort of very, very, very poor relation of men's sport. Where I am very focused at the moment is a similarly depressing stat, which is around female entrepreneurs raising capital. So that number sat around the 2% mark for about 15 years. Prior to that, it was worse. We're 2% of all capital, and to take a UK figure, invested into entrepreneurs goes to back a female CEO, 2%, even though women deliver 35% better returns than men, by the way. And it just isn't shifting. So when I think about something like that, back to this point on standing for something, I've been appointed by the government in the UK, by the Secretary of State for Business, to chair something called the Invest in Women Task Force. And my objective there is to raise the biggest funding pot in the world to back female entrepreneurs to make the UK the best place in the world to be a female founder. And I think this stuff takes systemic change, right? It isn't going to happen unless we have proper interventions and incentives. And so by targeting this funding pot, which is industry-backed but government-supported, comes from investment banks, pension funds, underwritten by the British Business Bank, I think something like that is very important signaling, because without money, it's just, we're just talking, right? If we've got money, then what happens if you take the UK, which is where, you know, I spend the majority of my time as a case study, if there's money here, then what happens? Investors come here, entrepreneurs come here, you change the conversation. I'm a big fan of quotas. You know, I really do believe that, and the only thing that's worked in the history of business feminism is the 30% club, right? Which lobbied for 30% of representatives on boards to be female. It worked. They now are. Goldman Sachs will not IPO a business without a woman on a board. This isn't the last decade, right? So I think across the board, it's going to take more than a nudge. It's going to take money, and it's going to take a target, and it's going to take an incentive, and it's going to take legislation. I really do believe that. I think that way we can drag it. But I think what happens is I've been really successful in my career because I'm particularly good, it turns out, at asking men for money. I mean, that's a bit weird if you think about it, right? Because I've never been in a position where I'm able to ask women for money because women don't hold the pen in the main. They don't write the checks. On the other side of the table, only 2% of investors at partner level are female. So across the board, I think we can drive systemic change if we put together signposted funding pots to say this is going to change and if we enforce quotas. I think without that, the rate of change is just not happening. It's too slow.
Yeah, the 2% statistic, also staggering, but, you know, seems like when we had Angel City on stage with us at Advertising Week in Sydney, what an incredible story that is. So you hope that the needle is really going to start to accelerate. A friend of ours here started Athletes Unlimited, which is all women sports leagues. They're doing very, very well. And enormous upside, you know, from a business vantage point and a bottom line vantage point. So you hope that that momentum will accelerate.
I mean, you know this better than anyone, Matt, but brands follow eyeballs and money, right? And I think if you start to shift it, then the ecosystem creates around it, then, you know, people like you who are amazing at putting together curated events start to focus on that if the money's there. So I hope there's a tipping point. In the UK, we generally follow the lead of the US. I feel like it's coming, but it's going to take proper money and proper incentives.
Yeah, no question about it. So let's talk about the Albright, which is how we met. And that's sort of the next logical evolution in our conversation now about leadership and women. You and Anna put together something that was a really charmed, fantastic run. I think COVID got in the way a little bit, to say the least. But you really created something that was extraordinary and has left a legacy. And I'm going to guess that as you look back over the continuum of your career, that's got to be one that's pretty high up top on your list of things that you're probably, I'm going to guess, most proud of.
You know, life only ever makes sense with hindsight, doesn't it? You know, when you're in it, it's kind of sometimes hard to figure out what the red thread is. But the red thread for me with Albright was this point about picking people up along the way and or moments of serendipity. So AJ and I, you know, have this incredible friendship, mutual respect. She's the only person I know who'll WhatsApp me at 4 a.m. with equal sort of gusto on things that keep me awake at night. She's just an all-round star and I love her. And we met at a party that I knew didn't go to, of a parent from the school of my, you know, it's one of those moments. So I think if there's a life lesson in anything, it's, my mother always used to say, you're never going to meet the man of your dreams in your kitchen. And I think that's kind of right about life, right? Which is partly why, for many reasons, pandemic was so challenging, but it was very hard to build the network, which is transformative. And all the great things that have happened to me in my career have been because of the people that I've met. So I think Albright, a lot of it is the story of Anna and I, which continues to be a story in our, in the businesses that we build together and separately. It was amazing and awful. You know, it was really hard. Sometimes purpose plus profit is super difficult. We were absolutely flying. And then our revenue went to zero on March the 11th, 2020. And I mean zero. And who could have foreseen what that would mean for so many? I think that we built the business, we rebuilt the business, we reimagined the business. We had to build the, you know, plane as it was flying with everybody at home. But the business that emerged was one that I was very proud of. And I think it shows that out of adversity comes moments of steel. The team that we built was a team that I'm still working with and in touch with in many ways. And I think it comes up at the funniest times, Albright, in the gym changing room, on a plane, on a holiday, wherever, the difference that it genuinely made to women's lives and the ecosystem. I think it taught me a lot of lessons about what it means to move on. I've never done it that way before. You know, we sold a stake in the business, we brought in a new management team, we left. I've only ever stayed to the bitter end. I think closure comes in different ways, and recognizing when you're done and always leave them wanting more. I think that's a life lesson too. But I think what I've realized is from every business, because you get entrepreneurs like you, Matt, who, you know, are amazing and dogged, and they do a thing and they stick with that thing. You know, I'm not like that. I've got like 5 or 6 years of anything in me. And I think particularly if it's a D2C business and you're your own lowest cost of sales, you end up feeling like a stand-up comedian in need of some new material by the end. You know, like you've just told the story so many times, you're kind of sick of the sound of your own voice. So all of those things meant that it was time, and it's created the legacy of the things that we've gone on to do next, whether it's our Better Menopause business, which is one of the new things Anna and I have focused on, or just really staying close to and understanding the female consumer and what she needs. So I am super proud of it. I was also super tired at the end of it. And I think it taught me a lot about myself, and it taught me a lot about running a business in crisis. I've never had that before. You know, who of us had that moment in time when overnight the thing we thought we had just sort of drifted away? I think it teaches you a lot about life. And I think also teaches you about who's with you when it's really, really crap. You know, it's much easier to be on someone's team when everyone's flying. But I think when it was hard, the way that we pulled together and the way that Anna and I pulled together through sort of laughter and tears and gin and tonic and motivational pep talks and all the rest of it was a really powerful thing, and one that, you know, I won't ever forget.
Well, what is that old expression? From adversity comes strength. But at some point, isn't it enough strength?
I don't know. And life teaches you some hard, yeah, no, know enough already. Maybe, I don't know. I think without sounding sort of too hippie-ish about it, I do think life throws at you the stuff that you can deal with. I think the way that you deal with it is always instructive, right? You know, I always, this is a sort of literature nerdy thing, but one of my favorite authors of the last 15 years probably is Hilary Mantel, who wrote the Wolf Hall trilogy. And she voices over Thomas Cromwell, who was always a sort of great historical hero of mine, you know, the ultimate politician, brilliantly, when she says, the things you think are disasters in your life are not disasters, really. Almost anything can be turned around, out of every ditch, a path, if only you can see it. I've held that one very close. You know, it's literally written kind of on top of my laptop. I do feel like that. I feel like out of every ditch a path, and it's the path you find to the next thing, which gives you energy for the next thing. And that's how the next thing emerges. And if everything was brilliant all the time, then we wouldn't have that. I think you need the dark. You do need the dark. I'm as motivated by the dark as the sunlit uplands, right? I always have my FU list of people that I want to, you know, like I think you need, like we need to recognize we need both, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So as we wrap, Debbie, you mentioned a new business that you and Anna are doing together, the Better Menopause. And menopause has become a very big topic in my house. My wife is a little bit older than you. You know my wife, Isla. And Isla has really been educating me on the lack of education out there about menopause and how so much of what women go through is preventable, can be treated differently, should be talked about much earlier, that general practitioner doctors often miss things that could help women mitigate or at least know what's coming and be able to deal with it in a different way. And I feels like menopause is sort of coming out of the dark and into the light as a subject. And I'd love to touch base on that, an unusual place for a male-hosted show to suggest we go to wrap, but I think it's an important topic, and I've learned a lot from Isla. She listens to a phalanx of podcasts about the subject. I think talking about something is step one, certainly in public, much as a few years ago, all of a sudden, mental health came out of the dark and into the light. So I'd love to wrap by talking about what you and Anna are doing with the Better Menopause.
Yeah, I think all of those things are right. I mean, as ever with us, it takes a sort of real life moment. I know that there are people who are much more complex founders than me, but I always need something to kind of hook it into. And I got very sick in the summer of 2022, and I was in hospital for quite a long time. When I came out, I couldn't really get any better, and I had loads of tests, and I was told that I was in perimenopause, which I'd never heard of. And all I've ever done is be very hard driving. You know, I get up early and do what I need to do. And I just didn't realize that this was going to be something that affected me in my 40s. And when I had a load of tests, one of the things that was obvious was that my gut health had been so compromised by being on antibiotics for so long that that was having an impact on my health and on my symptoms. And I felt like there's so much conversation about gut health and the gut-brain continuum, but none of it ties to women and hormones. And so it felt like there was an opportunity for education, for products and services that really worked. And for something, there was a science-driven platform to genuinely give women a better menopause. And we do that through science-driven supplements, being able to speak to a doctor or a nutritionist, and HRT delivery to home. And we partner with Jo Lyle, who's the CEO, who's a clinical nutritionist, and Dr. Harper, who's one of the big menopause doctors in the UK. It feels really important. I couldn't tell you anything about my mother's menopause because she never talked about it. I think that it's changing. Where I really engage is that 25% of women over the age of 50 want to leave the workforce because of their menopause symptoms, and 10% actually do. So for me, it's always got to tie back to sort of where we started, really, Matt, which is the stand for something and female economic independence. Those are the things that really matter to me. It's hard enough as a woman to stay in work through the years. You know, the mean age to start a business is 33. That's when we're having our kids. You know, we've talked about the only 2% of capital. The last thing I want to see is women who've stayed in work, or who have returned to work, leaving the workforce because they're not getting the support they need for their menopause symptoms. So it feels really important. 15 million women in the UK are in perimenopause, menopause at the moment. So also from a commercial perspective, it's a massive addressable audience, where we're just at the early stages of talking about it. So if I think about how I can use the multiplier effect of the things I'm good at, the people that I know, people I picked up along the way, and standing for something, it feels like this chapter focusing on women in perimenopause, menopause, and getting them the help they need is a really important way for me to spend my time.
Well, I love this. I love your passion. It's infectious. You make a difference not only in your life, but on the people whose lives you touch. Important causes that transcend business and culture, and now health as well. And I can't tell you how much I enjoyed this conversation. There is going to be a Debbie Wasko Returns episode, without question. Have a wonderful day. I'll see you soon.
Bye, Matt.
Bye-bye.